Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 2nd of June. First hour of our program today, again, we will talk about the oil spill in the Gulf, which continues to dominate the headlines 43 days after the initial explosion. The Obama administration said yesterday that it had begun civil and criminal investigations into the massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and there has been a lot of criticism of the president and the way he's been handling this crisis. Today's New York Times says this may define President Obama's second year in office. Meanwhile, nobody knows how to stop this oil gushing into the Gulf, and it evidently is starting to hit Florida. So what to do? That's the first hour of our program. Second hour of our show, this is really a fascinating book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. We'll be speaking with the author of the book. The full title is Doctors Took Her Cells Without Asking. Those cells never died. They launched a medical revolution and a multi-million dollar industry. More than 20 years later, her children found out and their lives would never be the same. The author of the book, Rebecca Skloot, and the book's been on the New York Times bestseller list for quite a few weeks now. It's a fascinating story on many fronts. You'll want to be sure to listen to that. Both hours, you're welcome to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We have two guests with us. The first hour of our program today, we'll be starting with Kate Shepper from Mother Jones Magazine, and later we'll be speaking with Ethan Manuel, who's director of the Lands Protection Program for the Sierra Club. Kate Shepherd covers energy and environmental politics in Mother Jones' Washington Bureau. She was previously the reporter, political reporter for Grist and a writing fellow at the American Prospect. She's also been featured in the New York Times Room for Debate blog, and she was raised on a vegetable farm in southern New Jersey and has adapted well to life in the nation's capital. She writes in a recent piece in Mother Jones, Obama's sluggish oil spill response. Why has the administration been so slow to take charge of the disaster in the Gulf? Kate, thank you very much for joining us. Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. Since you wrote the article, which wasn't that long ago, May 25, do you think that the president has picked up his response?
Well, I think that in the days since then, we've definitely seen more action and more direct engagement from Obama. I mean, he gave that big press conference, I think it was just maybe 2 or 3 days later. He then went down to the Gulf to actually visit the site and talk to people there on the ground. That was much more direct involvement from the president than we've seen. I mean, overall, the administration has been trying very hard to, I think, present themselves as being responsible and in charge and doing more of that in the last week. But I think it still remains true that they've tried to keep their distance from this problem. They realize that this is something that doesn't really seem to have a solution. It definitely doesn't have an easy or quick solution, and they want to keep the blood here, the oil on BP's hands, and keep some distance from their problem too.
Isn't it so disturbing that this doesn't seem to have a solution? They keep trying one thing after another. It doesn't work. There's a problem with this. And in the meantime, the oil is gushing into the Gulf and spreading. It's horrible.
Right. It really reveals, I mean, I think as Americans, we have this faith that technology can fix things, that whatever we break,
yes,
we can fix some new scientific development. But this has really made it clear that we're out there in the Gulf, we were drilling holes in the ground that we've didn't know how to fix, and we might have to live with this for quite some time.
You wrote in your piece, a coalition of 10 conservation groups have called on the federal government to take charge of monitoring the spill and its environmental impact. Who is monitoring the spill? Is it the federal government? Is it BP? And have we received all the information that we should be receiving?
Well, it's a combination of the two. It seems like BP still has the majority of the control, both over the information coming directly from the spill site and then what we're seeing, you know, happen on land and in the water. They've been doing a lot of their own testing and monitoring, and the government's called on them to put this all online, but, you know, we really have no idea if they are disclosing everything. At the same time, the government also has their own activities in place. We have the have NOAA out there doing monitoring in the water. The EPA is doing air quality monitoring on land. So they also are playing a role here, but it seems like BP still has control over the majority of the information, and we have really no reassurance that they've been totally upfront with us.
The administration, it's pretty obvious, would prefer the blood stay on BP's hands, but it isn't staying there right now. Can you talk about the political fallout here if the administration is rightly blamed by a number of people who are saying that he just needs to take over BP and totally be in charge of what's happening here? Is there valid criticism of him?
Well, I think there's valid criticism that they were a little bit slow to take this seriously. I think that's true, and I think that it's true that they probably should take over more control from BP on the containment efforts, on the keeping it off land, on cleaning up the shores and all of that. It doesn't seem like BP is doing a particularly good job of that. They've left BP in charge of stopping the well, and I think rightly, because the government doesn't have the tools to stop it either. This is something that the oil industry should know how to do. So there are some places where the government actually probably should be taking the lead, and there's some places where it probably makes sense to leave BP in charge with some direct oversight from the federal government.
And can you talk a little bit more about the Senate voting, when they voted and why they voted to cap the liability here, not to raise the liability? This is obviously going to cost a whole already has a lot of money to clean this up. Why did the Senate vote that way?
Well, this happened back in 1990, shortly after the Exxon Valdez. They passed this Oil Pollution Act, which it had a number of good things. One, it created this fund that comes from a tax on gasoline that's 8 cents right now that is created to pay for disasters like this. That was good, but it also capped this liability for individual companies at $75 million, which maybe at that point in time seemed like a reasonable figure, but clearly, between inflation and just the enormously high cost of a disaster of this magnitude, that's nowhere near high enough. There's an effort underway right now in the Senate to raise that. They were going to raise it to $10 billion, and now they've decided, they put forward a bill that would just remove this cap entirely, which would obviously be the right thing to do here. There's no reason we should have a cap on liabilities for companies who are out there drilling in our waters and potentially polluting them. But those efforts have not actually had any success yet. They've been blocked numerous times. So
why?
Whether the Senate will be able to move forward is still unclear.
Yeah, if there were ever a time to pass it, though, now is the time. What could be holding them back?
Well, there's obviously some political tensions here between Republicans and Democrats, like there is on basically everything. You think this would be something that people could come together on, but clearly they have not. But there's been a number of Republicans have argued that setting a liability cap so high, either $10 billion or none at all, would keep smaller producers out of the business of offshore drilling, which, if they can't afford to pay that liability, they probably shouldn't be out there drilling. So it's a bit of a specious argument. But other Republicans have put forward their own bill that would just remove the liability cap for this particular incident. So there's a bunch of back and forth squabbling going on this issue, and I think it'd be something that people could actually come together on at this point in time.
And tell me, what is the policy now, Kate, in terms of expansion of offshore drilling? The president talked about that some months ago. Is that in limbo? Is it at a halt? Are they redefining what the policy will be?
So at the very end of March, just a few weeks before this bill, Obama announced this major expansion of offshore drilling. They were going to open some new areas of the Atlantic coast, the Gulf, the Arctic for drilling. Obviously, this disaster put that into a new light there. Obama immediately called a pause on that new expansion, and then last week they announced that they're going to continue that pause for 6 months while they figure out, exactly what we need to do to ensure that drilling offshore is can be done safely. There's also, so that's on pause for now as the Spill Commission investigation continues and they figure out how to proceed on the executive level with offshore drilling. At the same time, the Senate is considering a climate and energy bill, which will also deal with the offshore drilling question to some extent. the way the Senate bill is written, it would give states veto power over their neighboring states on offshore drilling. So if Virginia approves offshore drilling, but New Jersey says no way, if you have a spill, it will affect our beaches, and it can be proven that that is the case, then New Jersey would be able to veto other states, and every state would be able to decide how whether or not they want offshore drilling off their coast. So in operation, most people in Senate believe that means that there actually wouldn't be an extension of offshore drilling, that most states would probably reject it, and even those who approve it would be rejected by other states nearby. So the anticipation is that if that bill were passed, as the language stands currently, there wouldn't actually be any offshore drilling, and we wouldn't really have to worry about that extension proposed by the Obama administration in March.
We're going to try and get you on a little better phone line here because it's breaking up a bit, and we'll welcome phone calls. Our lines are filled. A lot of people want to talk about this, so just hold for one moment and we'll be with you. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, the email address talk@WPR.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kate Shepard is our guest. This first half hour of the program covers energy and environmental politics in Mother Jones, Washington Bureau. A little bit later this hour, we'll be speaking with the director of the Lands Protection Program for the Sierra Club, who oversees campaigns to protect public lands such as national parks, wildlife refuges, and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We go to phone calls, starting with Diana from Blair. Hi, Diana.
Hi. My comment is this, that every person and pundit and so on down the line who has criticized environmental groups for saying this deep sea drilling cannot be done safely, please look at it, should either be prosecuted or at the very least be forced to make public apology. And every organization and politician and so forth that has called for cuts in budgets for the EPA and other agencies that could respond to this and protect the environment should be prosecuted. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Do you have any more word on the civil and criminal investigations that have begun that were announced by the administration yesterday, Kate?
Nothing really new from yesterday. They announced officially that they are conducting a criminal investigation as well, and Holder said that they believe that they have enough evidence to merit that investigation, which I think is significant news. A number of senators have been calling on them to take a look at the criminal aspect here, and obviously that they were going to face civil charges for a number of violations of environmental standards. You know, it'll take weeks, I think, months probably, before we know what those charges might be and what they will look like. And there's ongoing investigations into what exactly happened on the rig before it exploded. So we'll probably have to wait a little while before we know exactly what the Department of Justice is going to say about this.
Jason in Appleton, hi.
Hey, good morning.
Hi, Jason.
Hey, I have recently read and then saw on the news, and I did a little research, so I do believe it to be true, that in Canada, for sure, and I'm sure other countries, when you're drilling at this sort of a depth, a relief well, which is what we're drilling two of now after the fact, a relief well has to be drilled. In Canada, if you drill at this depth, you have to drill a relief well, but in the case that something happens bad, they can automatically start pumping, you know, through this other relief well. If we would have had that regulation here in the U.S., which we don't, I presume that this would just have been a blip on the radar, and we would have heard about this maybe over the course of a couple of days, and that none of this would have happened before. And I guess I just want to reiterate to people that our government has sat around for decades not doing anything to try and move us off of oil. Obama is the first president that seems to be making any sort of an effort to do that, and he's getting criticized for it. And if we would have started to take care of this decades ago, we wouldn't have to drill in these type of waters as well. So I guess I would just like to guest comment on that.
All right, Kate.
Oh, you're absolutely right on both accounts there. One on the relief wells. yes, those are required simultaneously during drilling operations in Canada. There are a number of other protections for or safety precautions that other countries require for offshore drilling. Emergency shutoff system backups, additional safety rules. But in the U.S., we've basically let the oil industry self-regulate for many, many years. It's absolutely true that we probably could have forced a lot of different safety measures that might have prevented this particular incident in the Gulf. On the second point, yes, you're absolutely right. This should be a reminder that it's dangerous, and the further we go into offshore and the further we go into deep water, the more we have to face the reality that it's dangerous and it's hard to solve a problem when you're working a mile below the water. You're right, the Obama administration has taken a number of steps on fuel economy and other ways of reducing our oil use, but the idea that we still, for some reason, promote this idea that we need to drill offshore and that we need to drill here in the U.S. to solve this problem is clearly misguided.
Considering the fact that most people are extraordinarily upset by this and there is no end in sight to this gushing of oil, why doesn't the administration consider, and maybe they are, some kind of national conservation program? You know, turn back your thermostats, turn down your air conditioner, carpool when you can. I mean, it may be a simple kind of thing, and yet it would serve two purposes. One, that the administration would be actively involved in putting together some kind of program, and it would get us thinking in a day-to-day way about how dependent we are on oil and how we need to cut back on our use.
Yeah, it's an excellent idea. But if you recall, in 2008 during the election, we had the Republican vice presidential candidate out there saying "drill, baby, drill," and the entire country almost echoing that. There's an outcry. Like, people wanted us to drill offshore. They're out there chanting "drill, baby, drill." They were upset that gas is over $4 a gallon, and the Republican Party and a number of people in the U.S. had convinced them that drilling was the right answer. At the same time, Obama actually said, we can actually save more oil by inflating, keeping our tires inflated and, driving our cars in a smarter way. And he got laughed at. People were out there handing out tire gauges to mock him. And, he was actually promoting the right policies at that point in time. The political system has responded to Americans demanding offshore drilling for many years, and it's starting to turn around now that we have this disaster and people realize the consequences. But a lot of this happened because Americans wanted it to.
Yes, but this is the time to get people thinking. It seems to me this is the time.
This is absolutely the time. And if we look back over history, whenever we pass landmark legislation dealing with the environment, it's been after a disaster. It was after the Santa Barbara oil spill that we formed the EPA and put in place the National Environmental Policy Act. It was after the Exxon Valdez that we passed this Oil Pollution Prevention Act, passed the Clean Air Act. We, historically, these kind of disasters have become opportunities. Whether that will be the case here is really, I think, up to Americans.
Valerie in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi. I was calling in because I've listened, I'm a regular listener of NPR, I've listened a few times to programs regarding this subject, this bill. Like there was one on last week. And I find it very curious that a couple of times I've heard commentators say that we don't know what happened. And yet when I watched 60 Minutes on May 23rd, there was a man named Mike Williams who was a survivor of the disaster, and he explained in the weeks prior to the explosion, what happened. He explained that the annular, which is the big rubber stopper that's supposed to stop supposed to plug up the pipe if something goes wrong, and the annular was falling apart because pieces of rubber were coming up from the pipe in the well, and they knew that was happening. And yet they just said, well, we're just going to go on drilling anyway. That's what BP said. So we have this witness who says this is what happened, and they knew that this is, that things were going wrong, and yet they just continued on. And yet I find people in the news media saying we don't know what happened, and I'm confused by that.
Kate.
Oh, Well, no, you're right. There have been numerous witnesses from the rig who've come forward and said, you know, this is what happened leading up to it. We've had a number of documents that came out in the last few weeks of congressional investigations that said, you know, here's where BP cut corners, or here's where they were rushing through this job, here's where they ignored a bunch of warning signs. And that's true for BP and the rig owner, Transocean, and then there's also Halliburton, who was you know, cementing the well here, which also may have been part of the problem. I mean, there's an ongoing investigation into exactly who made what decisions and why those decisions were made. I mean, it's clear that these companies did something wrong, and this is why this happened, but, you know, exactly what the sequence of events were and who made the decisions is I think, still being determined. You know, for the news media, we have to treat individuals as innocent until proven guilty. So there's an ongoing investigation. We can't, you know, we have to wait and see what exactly they determine.
Considering what we know to this point, though, and BP's response and the lack of systems in place to contain this disaster, would you say that BP is a particularly egregious offender in this industry or not?
For a number of people I've talked to in the oil and gas industry, they think that BP is known for cutting corners and taking some safety risks. You know, and this wasn't the first incident. In 2005, they had a refinery in Texas that exploded and killed 15 workers and injured more than 100 other workers. They had an accident on their oil pipeline in Alaska a few years ago that, you know, dumped a lot of oil there. They've had a number of safety violations. There was a study by the Center for Public Integrity that found that, you know, 90% of the OSHA violations in the oil industry were BP.
Oh my.
In the last few years. I mean, they have a very outstanding track record here of failures when it comes to safety and planning. So I think it's definitely become clear in the last few weeks that this company was taking a lot of shortcuts and taking a lot of risks that may have caused this kind of accident.
Yeah. One more phone call for you. Camille from Frankfort, Michigan. Hi, Camille.
I'm glad you're talking about this again today because I have two questions that I've been hoping to ask someone. The first one is that normally the movement of unencumbered waters, the oceans, rivers, the movement helps clean those waters. Now, in this situation, I'm wondering, in the long run, what will the movement of the waters do to this situation? And, for example, what happened over the years after the Exxon Valdez that the movement of the waters contributed to? And the second question is, if there is some citizen, somebody out there somewhere, who has an idea, a really good idea, is there any way they can get through? And how would they get through to someone? So I will take my
answers
Camille. Off the air.
Thank you.
So dealing with, I guess, the last question first there, if people have ideas, there is a BP has put up a link on their website and a phone number for people to call and suggest their own ideas. The Coast Guard, when you call the command center, they also are taking suggestions. I mean, I have no idea how seriously any of those are being taken or whether they're going into some vault somewhere that might never be looked at, but they are soliciting, input from folks out in the world. The previous question was...
The movement of the water.
The movement of the water. Well, there's a few things that could happen here from what I understand from experts here working on this. Yesterday was the first day of hurricane season, which is a huge consideration when we're talking about the movement of the waters and where this oil goes. The movement of the water, it can break down the oil. It can break into smaller droplets and speed up the biodegradation that happens. That's the case. That's true. But it also can spread the oil across a wider distance. And when we're looking at the Gulf, that's a big concern. And when we're looking at it heading toward Florida, we look at it getting caught in this loop current that carries water around Florida and up to the eastern coast. That's that's a bit of a concern as well. So it could speed the degradation, that's true, but it could also just spread this oil out more and even push it on land even more, which would be a big problem as well.
Kate, thank you so much for being with us. It's, I'm sure, a difficult story to report because it doesn't end, does it? There's no success here.
No, and then as I was just coming on the show this morning, the Coast Guard announced that the saw they were using to cut off the riser for this next plan to cap the wells seems to have gotten stuck. So we have just another setback today, and it's just a never-ending series of disappointments there.
Yeah. Thanks, Kate, so much.
Thanks for having me.
Kate Shepard covers energy and environmental politics in Mother Jones' Washington Bureau. Previously the political reporter for Grist and a writing fellow at the American Prospect. Ethan Manuel is joining us now. Ethan is the director of the Lands Protection Program for the Sierra Club, where he oversees campaigns to protect public lands such as national parks, wildlife refuges, and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and national forests, defend endangered species and the Endangered Species Act, and stop any new offshore and gas drilling. Prior to working for the Sierra Club, Ethan worked for the U.S. and the state public interest research groups, and he joins us now. We'll continue with our phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. As we were just finishing our conversation with Kate, we talked about today's setback, Ethan, and it makes a person wonder, how long is this going to go on? It seems as though there's one try, another try, another try, another try. 43 days later, nobody seems to have an idea of how to stop this gushing of oil. When is it going to end?
Well, the problem is, and thanks for having me on the show.
Yes, thank you, Ethan, and thank you for being with us. I'm sorry.
Well, the problem is, I think the only thing that seems to have a real track record is drilling a relief well. And for whatever reason, it always seems like it takes the companies 2 or 3 months to get a relief well in place. And so I think BP's kind of acknowledging that the mechanisms they have in place are pretty inadequate, say, except for this relief well, and they won't be able to have that in place and drill it until August. And so it's going to be 3 months until this thing is capped. And unfortunately, it seems like 3 months is the standard. There was another large oil spill in the East Timor Sea last summer in very shallow water, and it took that company 3 months to cap that well as well. So it just seems like that's the best they can do, which is pretty bad.
And the reason for not having a relief well in the first place is primarily financial?
Yeah, it's always cost. I mean, they're always trying to maximize, minimize costs and maximize as much money they make per well. So that is the main reason. I mean, the arguments against the relief well are that you basically have two wells in place you have to do everything twice, have that redundancy. But obviously, it's a lot cheaper than having this huge spill spew oil for 3 months. And so we think it's kind of short-sighted that the best they can do is have a rig in place 3 months later.
So that's the best. So we have to probably, because it seems as though everything they try isn't working, wait for that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sad thing about this, is that the technology for, once the shutoff valves don't work, the technology is not that great, and save for this this relief well. So the junk shot and all the other things they try to do, the top hat, all that stuff is pretty inexact, especially at 5,000 feet of water. So there's definitely a need for more relief wells. And the question we have is, I don't know why they don't have relief wells in closer proximity. So even if you don't drill one along with the regular well, you would think, especially here in the central and western Gulf of Mexico, you know, Galveston, Houston, New Orleans, Biloxi, all those cities have ports that service the oil industry every day. I'm not sure why they don't have relief wells closer to some of these, to the central and western Gulf, and why a relief well, for instance, isn't permanently docked in Galveston or some of these areas close by, so that they can get it there quicker.
Well, that makes sense. Do you think that there will be regulations requiring that, or will, once this is capped, people forget about this?
Well, I think now that will be, I think that discussion has started, and I know on the Hill that's one of the issues that members of Congress are talking about in terms of when they do tougher safety regulations and better regulations for oil drilling moving forward. So, because that one seems kind of common sense. And again, it took them 3 months. You know, in Australia last summer, when it took them 3 months to get this relief well from the Philippines over to the East Timor Sea. So they never seem to have them handy, and that seems to be one common sense thing they could do in response to this spill.
How do you assess right now, Ethan, the environmental impact?
Well, the impact is pretty huge in terms of just how much area has been closed for fishing, for instance, how much water pollution you're seeing in the Western Gulf. And then the potential for even larger damage is even worse. I mean, once the oil starts hitting the beaches in Alabama and Florida, you're going to see those areas shut down. But the biggest impact now has been on and the future and the potential for severely impacting wetlands and marshes in the Gulf is also huge, because you just can't clean oil out of a wetland. That ecosystem is so intricate and so fragile that any kind of, you can't really scrub oil out of these marshes and wetlands, or if it gets into the mangrove swamps of Florida, it's even harder. So this damage is going to be pretty severe, both in terms of what it's doing to fishing grounds, but also what it could do to beaches and wetlands.
And what about birds? What about sea animals?
Well, it's another problem. We've already seen the pelicans being impacted, pelican nests even on shore being impacted. And then this is a pretty fertile area for shrimp and fish and oysters, but then also quite a few marine mammals go through there, especially some whales. And so it's just an incredible tragedy, because the amount of oil is so large, and we're not going to be able to cap it until August. And the other big threat is, if there is a hurricane here, all bets are off about how bad the damage will be, because these plumes of oil are so thick that if a hurricane happens, a lot of that oil will go onshore. So we could see an onshore oil spill from an offshore rig. So it's just a horrible catastrophe all the way around.
Let's go to more phone calls. Lucy in Madison, hi.
Hi. I've been thinking, why can't they just pick the oil up out of the water? Because I saw on 60 Minutes a man walk up to it and lift it up with his hand, and I heard Bobby Jindal talking about seeing a fishnet that they used and picked up a bunch of it. And I don't see why BP can't go and do that, because the oil's worth just as much on the surface as it was under the water. And I know that there is technology to get the water out of it. I read an article about Kevin Costner having developed technology to do that. And there are a lot of fisher people who have small boats, and if the BP were required to give them some equipment and some barrels, they could go out and collect it and get paid by BP to collect it. So I don't understand why they can't just pull it out of the water more than what they're doing.
Well, I think it's just very hard. I mean, once the oil gets into the water, it's historically always been hard to get it out. And if you recover 20-30% of the oil from an oil spill, that's considered a success. Just because the ocean currents and the water dissipate the oil so quickly and spread it out in such a wide area, it's just always been historically hard to pick it up. I mean, the thing they're having the most luck with in the Gulf is skimming it and then burning it. Collecting it in these big booms and then burning part of it off. So this centrifugal force idea that Kevin Costner has is an interesting one, but it hasn't been proven yet, where you just dump lots of oil into this machine and then it spins the oil out of it. But it's always been very hard. The technology is not nearly where it should be in terms of cleaning up oil.
Go ahead, Lucy.
It just seems like our technology should be at a point where we could get the water out of the oil. I'm in a laundromat. it just seems like our technology should be where we could get, we could at least separate the oil from the water. When I saw that on 60 Minutes, the stuff is really a heavy, they were pointing out how the stuff is really heavy and it was sticking together a lot. So I don't understand why.
Right.
Why they couldn't do more with that concept.
Right. I mean, she has a point there. When you see it, it is all globbing together. You would think there would be a way to almost use, massive electronic fishnets to if you had a lot of boats there, to get this stuff off the water.
Yeah, I think, again, the big challenge is just covering all that area. It's such a vast area, and it's always moving. It's just for a variety of reasons, it just seems to escape the current technology, and the oil always seems to win. And once it's in the water, I think almost every petroleum engineer acknowledges, once it's in the water, it's we've lost, because just the technology is not nearly where it should be in terms of cleaning up these spills. Yeah.
Thank you, Lucy, for your call. Tom in Mequon, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. It seems to me that, yes, there is a definite huge responsibility on a BP's part. I think their first responsibility is to cap the well. Obviously, they have the technology more than probably any country's got. Although I think secondarily, I think the United States has more responsibility to protect our shoreline. And I think you've seen that this administration has not made an effort, especially since the very beginning, to take it seriously and to do something about it. And there's actually been the states along the Gulf have been asking for direction and help and okay to move, but the administration has stymied them. And I think that at least for the first month, that they looked at that as an opportunity to move ahead their agenda. I think also this shows that we need to open up the wells on our shores in Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Texas, and to allow them to be used more than what they have been used from too restrictive of laws.
Ethan?
Well, I think on the first part, I think this is definitely BP's responsibility. And when the companies apply to drill on these federal lands, I mean, they give the government assurances that they, in fact, in this spill, BP said they, I mean, in this case, BP said they could handle a very large spill in case one happened. And so the problem is that the agency that used to govern this area, the Minerals Management Service, was kind of had a revolving door between itself and the oil industry. So that industry, I mean, that agency was there to expedite the permitting of offshore drilling, and that's what they did. And they gave the oil companies what they wanted. So this clearly is an oil industry problem. It's BP's problem, and they should be the ones who clean it up and pay for it. I mean, the government doesn't have a oil spill cleaning up agency, and the Coast Guard doesn't have that mandate. And so this is clearly BP's fault, and we think they should pay for it, and they should be held responsible. In terms of oil, I mean, we think this argument, I mean, we think this spill, though, is clearly an argument that we need to get off of oil. I mean, this fossil fuel creates a whole bunch of problems, whether it's pollution or spills from oil and gas drilling, to the fact that it's what causes global warming. And then the other thing that complicates this issue is that we just don't have that much oil and gas left in the United States. We produce about 7 million barrels of oil a day, but we use about 20 million barrels of oil a day. 2 million of that 7 million comes from the Gulf of Mexico. So we can easily replace all the oil we get from the Gulf of Mexico just by making our cars more fuel efficient. So we think, in terms of technology, we should innovate our way out of this problem, and that's what we'd like to see this spill do, is become a wake-up call for the public and for elected officials to start getting to aggressively move to get the United States off of fossil fuels and especially off of oil within the next 20 or 30 years, because we think that's definitely doable and needs to be done if we're going to protect our environment, but also protect these coastal economies that support so many jobs and are such a huge part of the way of life in places like the Gulf Coast. But so instead of doing more drilling, we think this makes a pretty eloquent case for doing less drilling and doing more on efficiency and renewables.
And what are the chances of that happening, Ethan?
Well, I think now, you know, it's really picked up quite a bit of momentum on the Hill. I think we hope this will spur the Senate to pass a climate bill that starts to takes the first step to do that, to start doing more on efficiency and renewables. I mean, the president's already taken some very good steps in terms of mandating cleaner cars and cleaner trucks that go further on a gallon of gas than they would have otherwise. And so we're already taking some baby steps. We think we could really accelerate that, though, by placing a cap on carbon and a price on carbon and start making clean energy sources much more economical and move our nation away from fossil fuels towards renewables. And I think that's starting to get some traction here on the Hill in the wake of this terrible tragedy in the Gulf.
Yeah, and forgive my cynicism about this, but how many years have we been talking about that? A long, long time.
Yeah, since I mean, our talking points on this issue probably haven't changed since 1973, 74,
right,
when the first oil shock happened,
right,
where we recognized that the U.S. just uses too much oil and we don't have much of it left, and that we need to start moving off of fossil fuels and doing more on renewables, efficiency, clean energy programs that are domestic and good for the environment and would help reindustrialize the country to get us back to work, too. So we think this whole transition from fossil fuels to clean energy is just win-win-win.
Let's take a couple emails here. This one, I don't care if the $10 billion liability requirement, we were talking about that earlier, drives out smaller operators. If one of the largest oil companies in the world doesn't have the ability to stop this horror, how would a mom-and-pop operation, if they can't afford the insurance, then they shouldn't be doing it? Mark from McHenry, Illinois.
Well, on that one, I mean, the heart of that issue is you should be held responsible for your actions. And I think Congress may write it so that smaller companies can have access to different kinds of insurance. But that it gets to a good issue that the free market there shouldn't be a liability. It shouldn't be a cap on how these things operate. We don't put caps on most things in the marketplace. And so we agree in that there should be an unlimited cap and let the companies be responsible for what they do.
More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our show, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Doctors took her cells without asking. Those cells never died. They launched a medical revolution and a multi-million dollar industry. More than 20 years later, her children found out. It's an absolutely fascinating book. Rebecca Sloot is the author, and she will be with us following the news. Ethan Manuel is here now. He is director of the Lands Protection Program for the Sierra Club, and we're welcoming phone calls as we continue conversation about this massive oil spill. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Can I say a couple things? I'll try to be really quick. The first thing is, if it's dumping out 500,000 to 800,000 gallons a day, which is what the government said, you know, by the time this is all over, it could be approaching 1 billion gallons. And I'm just wondering about the impact of that on fisheries even before it hits the shore. And could it go, like, around the world and to other countries and impact their fisheries also? And then my other question is, although I sort of answered it while I was waiting, I'm wondering how fair it is to blame President Obama for not changing all the regulations about oil drilling and the culture at the licensing agency in the short time he's been in office. Because he hasn't been here very long. And but on the other hand, then I was thinking, well, if he's going to support more drilling, I mean, then it was his job to go and make sure it was safe. So those are my questions. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Sarah.
Well, on the first one, I mean, you already have seen a huge impact on fisheries. I think over 75,000 square miles of the Gulf have been, which I think is over almost a third of the Gulf, has been closed to commercial and recreational fishing. So it's already had a huge impact on oysters and shrimpers and other fishermen in the Gulf. I mean, there is a threat that this oil will get into the loop current. You know, there's a current that the Gulf current comes into the Gulf of Mexico, then loops back around the coast of the Florida Keys, and eventually goes up to the coast of North Carolina. So if it gets into the loop current, it'll get into the Gulf Stream. If it gets into the Gulf Stream, you could see it impacting beaches on the east coast of Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina. Ultimately, that Gulf Stream then goes northeast and goes to France and the British Isles. And so part of the reason why Northern Europe has a pretty temperate climate is because of the Gulf Stream. It starts in the Gulf of Mexico and extends all the way up to Northern Europe. So there's a potential for the oil to get as far up north, though, as North Carolina and Virginia, maybe Maryland. But it could go very far because of the Gulf Stream.
Lori in Richland Center, hi.
Hi. I have a question going back to regulatory agencies. We've heard over and over, and you mentioned it before, that there's a revolving door between industry and regulation, and I would also say between administration. And one of the arguments we hear from them is that they're best qualified to regulate because they know the inside of the industries. I know that's not true in the USDA and the FDA, where this is also a big problem. Do you have any other ideas on where we could draw experts for these regulatory agencies?
Well, the big thing, both on this question and the previous, and Sarah's question about the Obama administration, is they did recognize that MMS was a failed agency that had too many insiders with the oil industry. But obviously, the reforms they were making at MMS didn't go far enough. They fired the director, or the director resigned, Liz Birnbaum, and now they're reorganizing that. All the responsibilities of MMS will be broken up into three different agencies, and so I think that's probably a very important first step because MMS not only leases areas, but they collect a lot of revenue from these leases. And so I think it is important to break up the leasing, the revenue collection, and the permitting so that you have three different sets of eyes regulating what happens off of our coasts. But there are plenty. I mean, the best place to look for experts on this kind of thing are academia or other think tanks who work on coastal policy. And I think the important thing is to really balance it out so you don't have folks who are just focused on promoting new offshore drilling, but that you see it in a balanced approach so that you look on one hand on how much oil or gas could come out of a well, but also the other hand, what kind of environmental impacts it would have on local ecosystems, but also whether the safety measures are adequate and effective. I mean, one of the things that gets lost in this tragedy is that 11 people lost their lives at work, that 11 workers were killed working on this rig, and so that's one of the reasons why the government has launched this criminal investigation of BP and how they operated that rig, because they clearly didn't have measures in place that were either safe for workers or safe for the environment, and that's what needs to be institutionalized in these new government agencies, so that safety is paramount and is equal to resource extraction as we move forward with the drilling off of our coasts.
Thank you, Lori.
Move forward.
Steve in Madison, hi. Steve? I'm sorry, Steve, you're not there anymore. Steve in Sparta. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. I just have a comment. I'm a little confused. I don't understand how we can drop bombs in this country with unmanned airplanes. We can rocket to the moon and get out and walk around. We can rocket to space and get out and float around in space and even live in space for years and years. But we can't plug a hole 1 mile deep in the sea.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, we and we can. I guess BP will in a couple of months, but it takes some months to do it. And that's a good point. And we look at those examples, though, as why we can't get ourselves off of fossil fuels. Like you said before, Kathleen, we've talked about this issue for 30 years, probably since the first oil shocks of the 70s. We've known that staying hooked on oil is unsustainable, and we've known that for years and years and years. But still, we haven't done anything about it. So we hope that those examples that Steve just used about space travel and all the other technological innovations we've made on so many other parts of American life can be finally applied to transportation and the way we use fossil fuels. I mean, if you look at everything in America, so many things have gotten different, whether it's cell phones or the way we communicate via television and the internet, stuff like that. A lot of banking, all these industries have changed with technology, but energy policy really has not yet, and that's the next big frontier that we think we need to challenge as a nation is to solve this problem of energy and get ourselves off of fossil fuels in the next 20 years.
Thanks for your call, Steve. Here's an engineer, Jim in Green Bay. I can think of 5 ways to cut off the pipe and place a ceiling cap on the end. Why isn't this a feasible solution? Is it that there are sub-seafloor leaks also? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, I think the biggest challenge on that, again, is that it's at 5,000 feet, and they're doing this all remotely with robots. And so I think that they've tried that solution. In fact, that's how a blowout preventer works, is they have these redundant measures that try and cut off, plug up the pipe. And for whatever reasons, they haven't worked yet. And I think the biggest challenge seems to be the depth of the water. But no one knows why this happened in the first place. I mean, BP says they had systems in place and that should have capped this well. During hurricanes, the companies, to their credit, do a good job of capping these wells when they know a hurricane is coming. But for whatever reason, they couldn't do it here on this one rig. And so no one really knows what the answer is yet.
Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. Indeed, we are living in a tragedy. But let us remember that after the explosion at Mount St. Helens, the Earth renewed itself in a very quick time. It was green within 2 years. Let us remember that the Earth has self-healing properties. And I'd also like to say that France, for many, many, many years, has had 80% of its power supplied by atomic efforts, and they don't seem to be worried about where their Mount Yucca is. So I'd like to see a lot more money put into, and time and energy put into that kind of power source. Thank you.
Ethan.
Well, we think the Achilles heel of nuclear power, obviously, is its cost. It's just phenomenally expensive to to build a nuclear power plant and to give it and to maintain it. We think that money can be much better spent. And then obviously it produces lots of waste. And for a long time, you know, France dealt with it by just shipping it to former colonies, but they reprocess a lot more of that waste now. But the waste is still a problem, it's still a challenge in France as well. So we think there's better ways to spend that money, and that's where we think, again, that renewables, in terms of energy efficiency, solar power, wind power, other renewable sources besides that are, that don't produce this toxic waste are the best place for us to spend money and invest our energy future.
Just quickly, we have about 30 seconds. Somebody's worried about tidal waves as the oil reservoir is drained. The seafloor above it might collapse, causing a tidal wave that would make a Trina look like a child's play.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever happened before. I mean, we've been drilling offshore for 40 years in the United States, so and they have in other parts of the world too. And I don't think draining a reservoir has ever caused that kind of collapse to trigger a tidal wave. That's more of a seismic event.
Okay. Ethan, thank you so much for being with us. Yeah, thanks. Our pleasure. Ethan Manuel, Director of the Lands Protection Program for the Sierra Club, overseeing campaigns to protect public lands like national parks, wildlife refuges, and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We thank him for being with us and also being with us on the air this hour, Kate Shepard, environmental reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your calls of concern and information today. It was a good hour. And please stay tuned for the next hour. It is one gripping story on so many fronts. Ethics, medicine, race, poverty, you name it. That's coming up soon.